Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNRadio.com/Behind the Badge.
About the past 45 minutes, President Trump has been speaking regarding the death of ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. I assume you're going to be having portions of the president's comments this morning, right, Shawnee?
Oh, absolutely, yes. As a matter of fact, we had excerpts in the news here just a few moments ago, and at 8:30, he began to speak around 20 after 8, just confirming what had been reported really overnight, that al-Baghdadi died after detonating a vest he was wearing, also killing three of his children in the process during this raid.
It was some of the points that the president made during his speech were interesting ones. We're going to be talking both with ABC News to get the overview of the story, and also terrorism expert Tom Mikaitis, a professor at DePaul University, about what this means, who this al-Baghdadi was, put a little perspective on the whole story coming up in just a few minutes. But that is the big breaking news. The president first tweeted this morning, big news. All he said is there's very big news.
And something big has happened.
Right. Yeah. And, didn't really say what was going on. Speculation began what had happened. Reports were beginning to come out of the Middle East as to what had happened. And then, as I say, about an hour ago, 55 minutes ago, something, the president came on and confirmed the news. So we'll talk more about that in depth in just a couple of minutes. Got a full show today, and that will include some highlights from where I've been the past couple of days, Los Angeles, California. You know, it was 90 degrees there the other day.
That's what you were saying yesterday, that it was 90.
Oh, my body can take these extreme temperature changes.
You did okay yesterday.
Yeah, right? I thought the walk would do you good yesterday.
I felt great when we got done with the Alzheimer's walk yesterday. But, 90 degrees in L.A., where I talked with a couple of up-and-coming actors. I don't know if you've heard of them. Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, Martin Scorsese.
They're pretty good.
Joe Pesci. You laughing at me? What, am I a clown?
Do I amuse you?
They're in this new movie called The Irishman, this new Netflix movie, which I've seen. We'll talk more about it. I'll tell you more about it. It's an amazing movie. It's an amazingly made movie. It's also 3.5 hours. I can't think of too many things I want to do for 3.5 straight hours. That's a long time to do anything.
That's like Gone with the Wind length, Ben-Hur length.
You could watch 5 innings of a World Series game.
You know, somebody... Yeah. Somebody was saying, oh, you know, we're such a short attention span world now. Nobody can sit through a long movie. It's not short attention span. It's 3.5 hours. That's a long time to sit in a chair, to sit in one place for 3.5 hours. You know, relatively still is a long time. Plus, you add in the beverage factor into this whole thing for 3.5 hours. It's a long time.
Did you sit through the whole thing?
I did. Yes, I did.
Did you get restless? I can see you squirming around.
Oh, I was incredibly restless. Yes. It's incredibly restless. Plus, when I go to the movies, if I can, I like to sit on the aisle. So I can stretch a little bit.
Stretch, or
wiggle around a little bit. I was right in the middle of two hefty other critics. You know, critics tend to be on the hefty side. Because all we do is sit around and eat milk duds and popcorn all day.
Did they talk while you were trying to watch the movie?
No.
Okay.
No, there was no talking.
Good. Good.
Somebody in the aisle in front of me turned their phone on in the middle of the thing. They were so important that apparently they had to check their texts. But that was the only annoying thing that happened.
It never fails. This after you are told very politely and nicely.
Come on, this
please
is
please silence your cell phones on electronic.
One of the biggest movies of the year. This, you know, this very easily could win Best Picture. I mean, it's a really good movie. The only downside of this movie to me, it's 3.5 hours long. To sit through the whole thing without a break is difficult. But it's a really well made film. Very, very interesting story. It's coming to Netflix, so it's going to be in theaters first on November the 8th, and then it's going to be coming to Netflix. So I'm telling people, wait till it comes to Netflix, where you can pause it in the middle and you know, go do your income tax and come back. So anyway, we're going to talk about that later on. We've got a lot of different things coming up. And as I'd mentioned, we will be digging a little deeper into the story that broke this morning about the death of ISIS leader al-Baghdadi. And we'll talk with a terrorism expert. We'll get a couple of points of view on that so you know exactly what's going on in the world. Oh, and then we had this little walk yesterday.
It wasn't just a little walk. It was the
5K.
It was a good walk.
It was a good walk, yeah. And it was for a great cause.
We raised a lot of money. I didn't check our website this morning on alz.org, where you can still donate, by the way, for the Alzheimer's Association. But I know when I checked the other day, people are being very, very generous.
Yes, they are.
Donating to the Alzheimer's Association. You can still do that. Go alz.org. You click on donate, and then you click on search it for a team. And if you just put in WGN, it'll pop right up to our page. And you can support our team, because Shwani, Andy, and I did the 5K to support it all. And we had a very lovely morning.
We did.
We raised more than double our goal, I think, didn't we?
Oh, did we? Okay,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Except for the part where Andy and Shwani were mocking me because I was running a little late. I was.
Well, you weren't very nice to us in your response either.
I took a red eye.
You were not nice.
Directly from Los Angeles, from the way the schedules worked out, I took a red eye so I could be at the walk on time. But they were opening the bridges.
Uh-huh.
For the river, you know, for the boats. So I got delayed. I'm running late. Andy and Shwani sent me a picture of themselves looking at their watches.
Well, we were just wondering.
Where am I?
We were just wondering.
I was still on time. I was like 2 minutes. Andy got there at like 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, I wanted to help set up.
And you were there early. I said, let's meet at 9:30. I was there at 9:32.
9:35.
Yeah. Okay.
But who's counting?
It's 5 minutes late.
9:35.
But they send me this snotty picture of them looking at their watches.
Well, like, your response was a little more than that to us.
I did send them a photo back. I thought they might post that one,
did you?
No.
Okay.
No.
Please don't.
I've even deleted it off my phone.
All right, good
idea.
good idea.
Not a picture I want on my phone. Let me just say, I thought... you know, I just trimmed my nails, and I thought that they would enjoy. I thought they would enjoy seeing one of my fingers.
But it was the expression on your face.
That was the best part of the whole thing. It was the get off my lawn moment.
That was I don't care what you think moment. That is very true. But we had a very nice time, and we met so many nice people, and it was just a wonderful day. So thank you everyone who showed up. It's really crowded. A lot of people doing the walk. And tons of money raised for the Alzheimer's Association. Yeah.
I haven't seen a crowd estimate, but Andy and I were speculating earlier. 5,000 to 10,000 more and more.
I would guess that's probably about right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was very crowded. So it's very nice to see that so many people came out and, you know, we're interested in all of that. So before we go to our first break here and talk with terrorism expert Tom Mikaitis, let us go to ABC News to get some updates on the events of this morning. Actually, No, okay. Let us take a break and we go to ABC News. It's Mona Rivera who is on our phone line right now. Mona, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
The news that we've been hearing this morning about the death of ISIS leader al-Baghdadi, what can you tell us and what is the latest?
Well, we just heard from President Trump, who held a news conference to confirm that U.S. forces took out Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi in a military raid in northwestern Syria. The president called this a victory. He said that Baghdadi was hunted down by U.S. forces at a compound and that they started closing in on him. He ran down a tunnel, and as the forces closed in, he was wearing a suicide vest and ignited it, blowing himself up.
Some of the comments that when I was watching the president's comments today, he was talking about the disposition of al-Baghdadi during the military raid. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, he said that when the explosion happened, there was a lot of debris in the tunnel, and it made it hard to get to the body. So it's, I would say, what, 18 hours since it happened. He says that the troops were able to finally move the debris out of the way, confirm al-Baghdadi's identity, that they brought body parts back with them, even though there wasn't much left of the body. And the president says they have his DNA, that they have confirmed that this is al-Baghdadi, because there, of course, is some concern that the leader, his death will not be accepted by his followers.
I guess what I was talking about with in terms of his disposition was the president talking about how he was crying like a baby and whimpering like a baby. I mean, he went to lengths to discredit his disposition, I guess, for ISIS followers.
He said that al-Baghdadi spent his final moments in utter fear. He claimed that the ISIS leader was whimpering and crying, in Trump's words, a coward running and crying, whimpering, screaming. In fact, Trump said that there's footage of this, and he would like to have it released to see, so that the world could see how he died.
I know you have another commitment, Mona, that you need to get to. I appreciate you taking a minute to join us. Mona Rivera, ABC News, thank you very much.
Last night was a great night for the United States and for the world. A brutal killer, one who has caused so much hardship and death, has violently been eliminated. He will never again harm another innocent man, woman, or child.
President Trump speaking from the White House earlier this morning on events of last night and overnight. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, leader of the ISIS Islamic State group, was killed in a U.S. military raid in Syria. Joining us on the phone line right now to put a little perspective on it all is DePaul University history professor and terrorism expert Tom Mikaitis. Hi, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning.
So I assume you watched the president speak this morning.
I heard his remarks, yeah.
What are some of your thoughts after his announcement of what's happened?
Well, of course, what everyone wants to know, everyone wants to know, well, what does this actually mean? So he tried to put that in the context, and he really very much tried to spin it as kind of a moral victory and an illustration to anybody who will try to join ISIS that this is what will happen to you. He also tried to wrap the operation around his Syria policy, for which has been very severely criticized. I mean, he was very quick to thank the Russians and the Turks as though somehow, that they were heavily involved in this, which I'm very skeptical of, and didn't say a whole lot about the Kurds, as if to say, well, see, my strategy in the region is actually successful.
Who was Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi?
Something of a shadowy figure. He was a relatively minor player in the anti-American insurgency who rose to prominence after al-Zarqawi, the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq, was killed. And in the years after, you know, the leading up to and after the American withdrawal, he kind of rebuilt his organization with former Al-Qaeda and Iraq fighters, as well as some, you know, disgruntled Ba'athist army officers and various others, and basically succeeded because of the brutality of the al-Maliki regime, which was very heavy in its treatment of Sunnis. And then he got a real boost and a real opportunity with the breakdown of authority in Syria during the Arab Spring, and then relocated to Raqqa and expanded out of there, quite successful as the leader of the Islamic State.
So what does this mean, his death this morning in this U.S. military raid that took place this morning? The president talked in pretty great detail about how, you know, this has been a mission which has been under works for quite some time now, how he was targeted down, how they chased him, you know, through a tunnel. He ran the al-Baghdadi running away with his children with a suicide vest on, and apparently, it was they're ready for capture, detonated the suicide vest, taking his own life, taking the life of several children, according to what the president said this morning. I mean, painting quite a graphic picture, you know, talking about how al-Baghdadi was crying and whimpering, you know, dehumanizing him in a way that I don't think we've ever heard.
Questionable accuracy. People who are whimpering and crying don't blow themselves up. I mean, you know, it seems to me as though that's part of, I mean, that you take that with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
I think he definitely is, the president was correct. This, something like this takes months to unfold. They probably had been putting together a successful intelligence puzzle. What it actually means, it would have been far more effective when there was an actual state, what we call a decapitation strike like this, taking out the leader, can have a far more disruptive thing. But this is much more like, you know, we are dealing with a time in which this is now a decentralized network. Not to say that he didn't have a role to play, not to say he wasn't trying to rebuild, but I'm far more worried about the fighters, of whom their estimates run anywhere from 14 to 20,000 and 3,000 of them being foreign. What will become of them? We saw last April with the attacks in Sri Lanka that the organization still has the ability to hit both in the near and far abroad without necessarily controlling territory. So in that sense, you know, it's symbolic as the victory was, as much as it was a move for justice, it's not going to mean the end of ISIS. And more worrying still, of course, is the broad ideological movement. What I'm really hoping is what happened with the death of Osama bin Laden, that in the raid on the compound that they managed to get information, intelligence files, things of that nature.
Yeah, which the president, the president did comment on that, saying that they were able to get files and information you know, captured it. So, you know, it only just happened a few hours ago. So what that information was, really nobody knows right now. But he did say that information, sensitive information was captured in all of that.
You won't know that for months. You won't know exactly what that is for months and years. But in the aftermath of the Abbottabad raid, you did see, you know, operations taking other people out. They received almost no attention in the media. But it also, the other thing, though, that those files revealed, that the organization was in process of rebuilding and still is. Al-Qaeda is not gone. And ISIS is not going to be gone either. So, you know, this is certainly, and I never want to say celebrate the death of a human being, but it's certainly something that is seen as a blow, you know, for justice and a moral and symbolic victory. I'm not sure how much it's actually going to weaken the organization or diminish the threat.
There's been so much talk lately about ISIS's renewal with the events in Syria with the Turks and the Kurds, and that ISIS now, according to reports, would be more free to operate again against the United States and our allies. Does that, does the death this morning play into that as well?
It's hard to know. I mean, I can see it going in a couple directions. One may be that the organization is disrupted and will have to restructure, or that you may see something very soon as a kind of a calling card to say, hey, we're alive and well. I think the real concern about the incursion, the Turkish incursion and the American withdrawal, is who has control over the camps and prisons in which the ISIS people were detained. And most of those in the area, I think, by the way, were camps that were housing families. But there's a lot of concern as to, I don't think think anybody really has a complete and clear picture as to all of the people fighting who fought for ISIS and where they are and what they're doing. And I think that is worrisome. And, you know, this will not terribly affect that. Now, one other thing has to be said. El-Baghdadi claimed himself to be the caliph, who's the leader of the Muslim world, the successor of the Prophet Muhammad. But so in that sense, the discrediting may have a somewhat stronger effect. It's very, very hard to know, and it will take some time to see how this plays out.
A negative effect in that it can be seen by some as being an anti-Islamic attack.
No, not at all. That, in fact, can be seen as, well, you know, is this guy really the Lord's anointed if he just got killed?
I see.
In the sense of discrediting his claim that he really was not the caliph. Now, caliphs are human. They're not, you know, and some of them have been killed and some have been seen as martyrs. So, you know, it may have that effect. It's just very, very hard to know what this will be, how this will play itself out.
After there have been attacks like this, and quote, victories in the fight against terrorism, we normally have seen both left and right, Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservative, come together in the cause of making America a safer place. Given the divisive world, unprecedentedly divisive world that we live in now, do you think that's going to happen this time?
No, I think what will occur is you will see Democrats giving credit to, you know, Navy SEALs and the military operation. They might very well say, well, look, this process of destroying ISIS was well underway during the presidency of Barack Obama, and essentially what you did was clean up. Not entirely fair, but I would expect them to say that. On the other hand, Republicans will tout this, oh, see what how successful his policies are. That's not entirely accurate either. So there's going to be political spin. I don't see any coming together. And as far as the nation goes, this operation does not have the emotional impact of the killing of Osama bin Laden. This is not you're not going to see people celebrating in New York City at Ground Zero the way we did, because he wasn't quite as real a person, because he never really, you know, hit the U.S. And al-Baghdadi was very careful not to be highly visible because, of course, he was afraid of being taken out. So, you know, he's still going to remain something of an enigmatic figure. And it's not impossible that the people in the region will deny that it's really him. I'm not a scientist, obviously, and you probably should ask one, but don't think you can do a DNA test quite as quickly as the president was saying, to verify that it's really him. I see no reason to doubt that it was Baghdadi. But it would not surprise me if, you know, some people will say, oh, it's just an American fabrication, they really didn't kill him, and so on. And since he hasn't been terribly visible, that would be a lot easier to pull off than was in the case of bin Laden, where the organization immediately admitted, yes, he's dead.
Yeah, on our text line this morning, if that's any indication, and there certainly is nothing scientific about it, people, you know, text in opinions on things, it's falling exactly on party lines. People's reaction to this is falling, you know, it's not a bit surprised, and not that coming together that we have sometimes felt as a nation when something like this has happened. Tom, I appreciate you taking a few minutes to join us this morning. Tom Mikaitis, professor of history, terrorism expert from DePaul University. Always good to talk to you, Tom. Thank you for your expertise.
Okay. Thank you, Dean. Take care.
Shawnee, we were talking about how our WGN Sunday morning team successfully did the walk to end Alzheimer's.
I brought in my flower. It's at on the desk here.
This was kind of nice that when you signed up and you registered, they gave you a
a wristband.
It's a wristband, but there's like a sort of a plastic.
It's
flower.
A pinwheel type of
it's
thing.
It's a pinwheel. That's perfect. That's what I was looking for. It's a pinwheel that looks like a flower in different colors, purple. Flower if you have lost someone to Alzheimer's, orange if you yourself are affected by it, yellow if you're a caregiver. So everybody has different colored pinwheel flowers, and it was very windy yesterday morning. My hair at the end of this was a mess.
I know you were looking for a place to comb your hair.
Yeah, all three of them were just completely out of control. But it was very pretty seeing these.
That's why I wore a hat.
Flying in the wind yesterday, and very inspiring. People had T-shirts. You know, I'm walking for you know, a relative, a friend.
Oh, yeah, whatever. I saw, you know, I'm walking for my mother, I'm walking for my grandmother.
Yeah, all very inspiring. We raised a ton of money. Thank you all for supporting our team. We appreciate that. But I had mentioned earlier that for the entire 5K, Andy and I had to listen to Shawnee describing every single tree, bush, nut, and berry.
Mm-hmm.
And I emphasize nuts.
Now, you know,
especially, but here's the point.
Okay,
here's why I'm bringing this up again, because we got a text from somebody saying, that's cute. We're doing a tree study in my preschool class. So you guys are on par with a bunch of 3 and 4 year olds.
That's about right.
Well, now, first of all, you, sir, were asking what kind of tree is this
as
we
joke.
Walk by.
I didn't think it was going to last for 2 hours.
I think
hours.
It was rhetorical.
So,
yeah.
You know, you might just say that we were doing a little tree time.
Oh, jeez.
Man.
I just thought of that.
Yeah. 2 hours Andy and I had to put up with this yesterday.
asked the question. I was trying to provide thorough information.
Yeah,
I still didn't find out what kind of microphone you used to record the victory.
It was spot. Thorough. I'll tell you that much.
Yeah.
It was very, very thorough.
Yeah, even at Soldier Field, he was trying to describe the covering that was on the field before the 2 inches of rain fell. And,
think of it. Here's how you
gave
look
me
at
an
it.
Answer. You, yeah. Simple question, simple answer.
Yeah.
You
it was
gave
a,
me the answer, yeah, Andy.
A very nice 5K walk that we went on yesterday. I'm very proud of all the. I'm very grateful to everyone who donated money, and you know, happy. But imagine spending 2 hours with Cliff Clavin from Cheers. That's I never see another tree. Welcome in, Dean Richards, Sunday morning, WGN. And always nice to chat with our friend Larry Potash from the WGN-TV Morning News. Larry, good morning to you, my friend.
Good morning, Dean.
So your backstory episode from last night, super interesting for those who are fans of or terrified of the movie The Exorcist, because... You did kind of the backstory of how real something like this was. It's going to repeat it tonight on WGN-TV. But talk a little about what you discovered in this.
Well, I went to the Mexican border to meet a psychologist whose mentor consulted with Friedkin, the guy who directed The Exorcist. And so they had some documents from the church, from the Jesuits, regarding what went on during the actual exorcist case that inspired the novel and the movie. And I think when people saw the movie, as you said, Dean, and the piece last night that runs again tonight, that I think people just felt like, well, this really happens, you know, and it kind of brought it to life.
Yeah.
And yet, when you read the documents of what actually happened, it's really... far, far less dramatic, and you can see how they kind of took an uncritical eye towards the entire thing.
Yeah.
And I think the other important piece of all this was the family was kind of into the Ouija boards and all that stuff, so when the doctors came in and said, hey, maybe the kid has epilepsy, why don't you take some pills, they kind of shooed him away and said, no, let us you know, do some exorcisms.
Yeah, we'll deal with this our way. To this day, I mean, people are profoundly terrified of this movie. And as I point out, I talked with Larry a little bit in this segment also, that people are so profoundly scared of this movie, terrified. It's not just like a scary movie. It scares them to the deepest part of their soul because it's something that's so relatable.
It is, even if it's not part of your belief system, I think that, you know, the guy with the hockey mask and at some level you think, okay, at some point the National Guard will come in, I'll take care of this guy. But, I mean, you know, when you're talking about demon possession, you think, well, geez, you know.
Yeah, who can fight that off? Who can fight that off when you've got a cute little girl walking down a flight of stairs backwards? You know, it's... That's something that's a little scary. So you'll be able to see that when Backstory is repeated tonight at 11 on WGN-TV. And you also talk about the Salem witch trials again as we get closer to Halloween, everyone's thinking witches and paranormal and supernatural.
Yeah.
All that sort of thing. What new things did you learn in this?
Well, I grew up next to Salem, Massachusetts, and so I was very familiar with it's this tacky tchotchke shop. And when you think about it, you know, it's Halloween Haven. And to me, it was somewhat disrespectful because, of course, what people forget, there were no witches. And there are these sites where people, innocent people, were executed and oppressed. And sometimes the tourists miss those places. So the tourist trolleys will not take you to some of these places. So I took the camera and we showed you a couple of those and gave you the sort of the deep background on how this all got started and why it got started and how it ended. And again, like a lot of these pieces, most people know like one or two lines about the witch trials, and that's all they know. So it was good to kind of just give people a refresher of what it is and what it isn't.
Yeah, I've never been to Salem, and I found so interesting in watching the piece that it reminded me of Graceland, you know, the area just outside of
right.
where Elvis lived and died and is buried now also, where it's just this cheesy, touristy area.
Yeah.
At, you know, where a person is buried, you know, a person lived and is buried.
Right. And the tourist lady, who I thought would be very defensive, really wasn't. She said, look, we weren't pushing this out. These people just started showing up. I think part of it was Halloween started to become a bigger deal and a right. bigger deal when we were kids. You know, yeah, you went trick-or-treating, but now it's like this multi-million-dollar industry, you know. And people are just really into Halloween, and that's kind of how it got started. And, of course, the Wiccans, the witch religion, the modern witch religion saw this, and I think they said, hey, this might be a good place to be. And they set up shop there. So now there are witches in Salem.
That's amazing. It's amazing. It's like going to Great America or something, though. It's so weird.
Right.
You'll be able to see the encore performance of Backstory tonight on WGN-TV. But I think, Larry, what all America is really waiting for, the annual Halloween tradition on the WGN Morning News, David the Rock Nelson?
Yeah, I mean, management thought I was nuts to put him on the air. And I said, I'm telling you, this is good stuff. And just to be clear, I said to David, I said, is it okay that we laugh at your scary movies that you make in your backyard? And he said, yeah, no, I want everybody to have fun. And over the years, his films have actually gotten better. I don't have to edit as much.
Better is a relative term, but
yeah, yeah, right, exactly.
Not as terrifying as they once were, I suppose. Terrifying in a bad way, but it's always entertaining. Do you know what he's showing us this year, this coming Thursday?
Yes, the movie is Miss Frankenstein, and, you know, usually what happens is he'll send me an hour of video, and there'll be some rubber masks and, you know, witches on a string, and then he'll be eating a tuna fish sandwich for 10 minutes, and I gotta edit that. So I try and make it look like something that we can watch, and, you know, it's unpredictable. Well, it's not even unpredictable anymore. It's pretty predictable, but it's Halloween, and it's a tradition on WGN, and we set the bar low.
It's good. It's incredibly entertaining. That's all I know. So that's going to be on Halloween morning. We always have a lot of fun and surprises on Halloween. Larry, we'll see you tomorrow morning.
Thank you, Dean.
That's Larry Potash. Thank you, bud. See you. That is Larry. His Backstory is every Saturday night at 10, original run on WGN-TV. It's repeated Sunday nights at 11, so you can see it tonight if you missed it last night, and then again Wednesdays at 7 on CLTV. And from where do we know this music, Schwani?
From the one, the only, Creature Features. It is named Experiment in Terror by Henry Mancini.
Correct. Chicago fans will remember the scary movie series Creature Feature, which many of us were introduced to.
The great Universal classics.
Frankenstein, Dracula, Werewolf.
Wolfman,
right. We use this music to introduce a show for this week's Week in Theater segment. Something that's going to be going on, that has started actually, and will play through November the 9th. Theater in the Dark's production of Three Stories Up. Schwani, this is a theatrical production which is performed entirely in the dark. Much like this show. Where we... imagine this. You go into a theater, they turn off all the lights, and then things start to happen around you. I think this is the greatest idea
things
ever.
Things start to happen around you?
Yeah. Again, much like this show. Let me introduce our guests. The director of Three Stories Up is Corey Bradbury. Corey, welcome to WGN.
Thank you so much.
Nice to have you here with us.
Great to be here.
And one of the performers in the show is Bethany Arrington. Bethany, welcome to you. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having
me. I love this idea.
Thank you.
I mean, there, you know, people do, try to do scary stuff for Halloween, but nothing like this. Talk to me a little bit about from where this came, and this is having a Chicago premiere.
Yes.
But actually, it premiered elsewhere first.
Right? Yes, it premiered in Vancouver, where our playwright Mackenzie Gordon is from originally. But he and I met very quickly after both of us moved to Chicago in the summer of last year. We met at a class in the Second City, and we ended up doing a showcase where we took the first 10 minutes and presented this in front of an audience. And the feedback was so great, we didn't even turn the lights off for that. We just invited the audience to close their eyes. Oh. And people got so engaged with the story, and so many people were interested in this idea of turning out the lights and closing their eyes, that then we went almost immediately into trying to find a non-traditional space that would allow us to present this play in a completely pitch black environment.
Yeah, and explain where you are performing this, because I think that adds so much to
the vibe
of this whole thing.
Yes. Yeah, we spent a lot of time, probably about 6 months, trying to find the right location, and we got connected through the Edgewater Chamber of Commerce that put us in touch with the church on Thorndale at 1244 West Thorndale. And it is the former Bethany Lutheran Evangelical Church, but we are the first performance group since that closed down a number of years ago to come in and present. So there's also a heavy theme and several scenes that take place in a church. So part of the audience experience is walking through the chapel before they are in the pitch black environment.
Yeah,
of
but I mean, if anything speaks to the importance of the set, the scenery, what's going on around the actors while the production is being put on, this does. Because it's this old, you know, how old churches are.
Oh, yeah, and the acoustics in the space has a nice echo to it that you just couldn't get in a black box around, even though Chicago has some wonderful black boxes. And so, yeah, space was the most important ingredient, and besides the people themselves.
Yeah.
And so once we found that, it was just like a match, and we have just done nothing but move forward, and the audience response has been so positive since we opened earlier last week.
Yeah, this is, I'm just going to name drop, because the story really ties in so well with where you are performing this production. Over the past couple of days, I was in Los Angeles and interviewed the cast of this new Netflix movie, The Irishman.
That's coming out.
De Niro, Pacino, Joe Pesci, etc. Pacino was telling a story of how when he was a young actor, much like your ages, he was at the famous Actors Workshop, and then he was auditioning for the great Lee Strasberg.
Yes.
And he was doing a soliloquy from King Lear that went nowhere.
Boy.
He said it was it went nowhere. But Strasberg, you know, realized that there was something there. Can you imagine Pacino doing, King Lear, number one? So Strasberg takes him to an old church. And like what you're talking about, the acoustics, the setting, and doing that. Doing King Lear in a church, he said it was revelatory to him. It changed his, it maybe made his career.
Well, and that doesn't surprise me, because as a director, I mean, space is such a critical ingredient, and especially you're always looking for what makes the play resonate the most, and you look for that in casting, you look for that in space, you look for that in the design, and since the story is so influenced by Raymond Chandler and that hard-boiled detective and the murder mystery genre.
Yeah.
To put it in this kind of environment, it's not a gimmick. It's not a tool. Or, well, I would say it is a tool to lift the language of the play up to a level that you wouldn't have if you were just looking and experiencing it as a traditional process.
And it's an extremely rhythmic play. Mm-hmm. It is a little bit like Shakespeare in that he even wrote, Mackenzie even wrote in stanzas, basically. So I know when I need to get to an end of a phrase, right? And when you've got an echo, specifically with, you know, maybe a few less bodies in the space or more bodies in the space, you get this feeling and it comes back to you.
I don't know what you're talking about.
It does, but it comes like you can hear the sound to people and bounce off bodies or bounce off the walls, and it's an extremely visceral experience, both for the actors and the audience.
Yeah.
I wasn't a huge fan of the echo initially because you hear yourself more and you're like, I'm just trying to get
distracting in the
beginning. I'm just trying to get to the end of the phrase.
Yeah, right. I can see where it would add to it so much. And then as I'm reading the description of what your play is, I haven't seen it yet, but I kept getting more drawn into it and into it and into it.
Yeah.
When I heard what you were doing, and I said, that's what we have to talk about this.
Well, and something happens, I think, about 10 minutes after sitting in the dark, and we've had people that say their eyes start to play tricks on them, like they start to imagine the spaces that we're describing in like very vivid detail. And I think that's one of the successes of the play and putting it in the pitch black, is that it unlocks the dramatic imagination of the audience, and they are painting in so much of that the actors are starting with the text and jumping off.
Yeah.
And so in that way, like Sir Ian McKellen, going back to Shakespeare, talks about, it's about how the sound rises from his body and how those words move through the space and how they land within your ears. And I think everything we've tried to do is about how do we get the actor and the audience to reestablish this relationship when they're so used to it being a visual relationship.
Well, we live in such a visual world. So then to step into a space where that's really, it's, you know, taken from you very quickly in a lot of ways.
Right.
And then to just engage with voice, just engage with sound. It's really exciting. It's different. It's completely different.
I think it's fantastic that, you know, you go from your safe zone, I guess, where you can see what's going on, you know, and you lose the ability to see what's happening around you. And then all of these suggestions that through the dialogue and sound effects and music start to, you know, your theater of the mind takes over.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and this play
I love the idea. I can't wait. We're going to do some. You're going to do some of it for us.
Absolutely.
Here in a minute, and I can't wait. But explain what is the premise of Three Stories Up? What's the story?
Yeah, so it takes place in Vancouver, where the playwright is from originally, and it follows the story of Beatrice Delorier, played by Bethany, and as she tries to put together the clues surrounding her husband's potentially brutal but very grisly murder/suicide, and it's about how she confronts the people in both her and her husband. Husband's life to come to grips with the truth about their relationship.
Yeah. Do people are people in pitch dark?
Yes.
Are there candlelights?
Or nope. 100% pitch black. We got special permits to cover exit signs. We have ushers on hand if anyone needs to leave early. But yeah, otherwise it's entirely in the dark.
What's it like for you to perform that?
It's really. I actually had a woman ask me after a show. I think 2 days ago, she was like, "Is it liberating? Is it liberating for you to perform in the dark?" And I said, absolutely. Because now I just get to use my talent. It has nothing to do. I've come to rehearsal. I've come to shows, you know, workout clothes, sweaty. No one's going to touch me. No one really cares. As long as I don't smell, I'm okay. You know, and no makeup. And I just get to do my craft. And it is so exciting every single time to step in, to get to tell the story, to get to to use a lot of my training that sometimes gets left behind when I'm doing other shows. The vocal, you can hear it in my voice. I'm a little fatigued. We had a two-show day yesterday. But I'm really using, you know, everything that is in my little actor toolbox, you know.
Your voice sounds fine, by the way.
Thank you so much.
But I get what you mean after a two-show day. You opened on the 24th, so you've got a few shows under your belt. Mm-hmm. Has anyone flipped out?
Yes.
Scared?
And it is an intense experience, although not potentially scary. A lot of people think they're coming into it with fear, but
it's
really
suspenseful.
It's suspenseful.
I've had to explain a number of times, like, I'm actually an anxious person and I hate scary things. So when I told my fiance I was doing this show, he's like, that doesn't really sound like something you do. And I was like, I know, I don't like scary stuff. But it's very suspenseful. And if you're in complete dark, I think a lot of people are like, I got to keep my eyes open. I got to see, you know, we're not physically engaging with you. Nobody's touching you. No one's like trying to scare you.
Yeah.
But
it's not like going to a haunted house.
No. Yeah. And if you're, I've told actually a number of people that actually closing your eyes in the dark, it relaxes the muscles in your face. That sends a message to your brain that, hey, I'm safe, I'm relaxed, I don't need to be on guard. And I think it becomes this really, like Corey, you told me once, you're like, I would just had a really nice time listening to you guys. Like, I relaxed, I closed my eyes, I chilled.
Yeah, and we were actually chatting before we came in that in the pre-show speech, so we've done a lot over the last few days since we opened to make sure that the audience is as comfortable as possible once we begin. And we even give them a moment once we turn off the lights to remove their blindfolds and just experience it before we even start anything.
Okay. Oh, so people had blindfolds as well.
Yeah. So you're led into the space blindfolded. And once you're seated, if you've pre-ordered a drink, an usher brings you your drink straight to your seat. And then
you don't go into the theater then and turn the lights off. Before you go in, you are blindfolded.
Mm-hmm. So you don't.
And seated.
Yeah. So so that way people come in with like no expectations about space.
I love this.
Yeah.
This is so fantastic.
It's so much fun. And then, so we do give them that moment to just remove their blindfolds and put it underneath. And there's always such a fun sound.
I call it the ooh moment where everybody goes, oh my God.
But someone
it's
actually,
so dark.
Last night, someone specifically said, oh, this isn't as bad as I thought. This isn't as bad.
My face is like, it's so dark. And I'm like, we told you it was going to be in the dark. Yeah. It's literally in the name.
Yeah. Well, so many people think that, though. They hear the dark and they're like, oh, well, it must be dim or it must be candles. And no, it is 100% pitch black.
I thought there must be candles or something like that. That you wouldn't bring an audience in completely in pitch darkness. But God bless you for going that extra mile.
I think the extra mile, I mean, it elevates everything else. Because as we were going through Tech Week, we would have some light leaks as we were still experimenting with the room. And once we got it to the pitch black conditions, I mean, it just launches what the actors are doing into the stratosphere.
That's fantastic. We're going to hear a little of it in a moment. You can call Close Your Eyes at Home to experience what it was actually like. It is 10:55. This is Dean Richards. Sunday morning. On WGN, our Sunday morning show before Halloween, and we're happy to be talking about this fantastic show, Theater in the Dark's production, Three Stories Up, that is performed entirely in total darkness. Our guests are the director, Corey Bradbury, and one of the performers, Bethany Arrington. What are we about to hear, Corey?
This is a scene towards the beginning of the play, the first encounter between Beatrice and one of her husband's informants.
Okay. Bethany, take it away.
This is how it starts. It's raining again in Vancouver. Sometimes I look at a room like a shot in a movie I compose. Back Tavern, Tunnel Town Curling Club, out in the suburbs of the city.
The only active informant in Austin's files. He called him half fish. Jotted down that Gunner reminded him of Caliban. The whole thing kind of looks like a Chuck E. Cheese Tunnel Town Curling Club, a place where nobody knows your name. Austin likes this spot, always half empty. The bartender minds his business, a safe place to grab a risky chat.
A cop. I know it right away. My fate is just a police negotiation away. Five limping steps, 3, 2.
I know you were working with Austin DeLaurier. Detective Austin DeLaurier, undercover squad.
But you don't know what I'm supposed to do now?
No.
Then I don't know what you're talking about.
You were an informant for Austin working on a case involving David Lee.
No.
Detective DeLaurier is dead.
Yeah, I know, I saw it in the paper. You knew who did it?
No.
Me neither.
Can I buy you a beer?
I've had enough.
Look, I don't know how to play these games. Please, I'm asking. Austin was my husband.
What?
Yeah.
You're younger than him.
I am.
Both cops?
I'm transit police.
I'm sorry, really.
It must have had something to do with David Lee.
Don't use his name. Call him Troy.
Okay. You work with Troy. I need to talk to him.
Austin told me about you. I thought he made it up.
I'm real.
He told you about me? I'm supposed to be confidential.
He didn't.
Then how'd you know?
I went through his files.
How's transit cop get access to that?
He kept them in a safe. I found his key on his body.
You found his body?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the files, you get a lot of them on other undercover informants?
Maybe.
Okay, then. Yeah. Why don't you buy me that beer?
Okay. Okay, then.
Three Stories Up. Theater in the Dark. It's being performed at the Church on Thorndale, 1244 West Thorndale in Chicago through November the 9th. And you can get ticket information by going to theaterinthedark.com, theater with an R-E, theaterinthedark.com, or 312-285-0314. This is such a fantastic concept.
Thank you.
This is why I love Chicago theater,
right,
where we can find great stuff like this. Appreciate you coming in, Bethany Arrington and Corey Bradbury. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been our pleasure.
Okay. Okay, here we go. Now, I love Chicago, the city that fathered me, called the second city, but that doesn't bother me. I gotta tell ya, I think it's the reverse, cause sometimes the second best is better than the first. Sometimes the second best is better than the first. Like, I don't like Google, I use Bing. I like French fries from Burger King. When it comes to Harry Potter, people give me grief, cause I prefer Percy Jackson Lightning Thief. I only drink Pepsi, never Coca-Cola. Jimmy Kimmel's fun, but I love Adam Carolla. And Robin Gibb, favorite BG. I hate Mario, love Luigi. Cause I'm the kind of guy that likes the second best better. I'm the kind of guy that likes the second best one. I like DMC better than Run. Cause I'm the kind of guy that likes the second best, son.
Hey. Chance the Rapper on Saturday Night Live last night. He started off the show with this special song for the city of Chicago.
So from San Diego.
The second city, wearing a Chicago Teachers Union sweatshirt and talking about his support for the teacher strike that's going on. So if you want to see that, it's available all over online. Reminder that in 2 weeks, we will be live at Tree Time in Lake Barrington once again. We're going to be doing the full show there live with all the players, like we've done in the past, right? Right, Dean?
I'm in.
Schwani, unusually quiet on the subject.
Yeah, it's almost like he's not there.
Because he's not.
I heard you.
He's busy. He gets busy.
It's been a busy morning in here, and it was continues to be busy. I have a newsroom to run.
Well, I got a show to do. We all got our we all have our crosses to bear.
We all have our things.
So are you excited about Tree Time?
Of course I am. Tree Time's always, that's a tradition anymore.
It is. Last year, I shot an apple off Schwani's head.
That I wasn't excited about.
with the bow and arrow. The year before that, we had a rousing game of Know Your Nuts. Maybe we'll do one of those two things again this year. We'll do
The Know Your Nuts, the answer to that is Dean, Dave, and Andy.
Jim, Elton Jim.
That makes four.
Always joins us because we, even though it's not even going to be Thanksgiving when we do this, it's November 10th, right? Isn't that the date?
Yeah. Yes, November 10th, 2 weeks from today.
We do our rousing edition, our listener version of the 12 Days of Christmas, which is always so horrible. It's fantastic. It's a tradition. People request it. So that's coming up 2 weeks from today. So I look forward to that. So I was just looking at how much money we raised at the Alzheimer's Walk. So far, you can still donate, by the way, by going to ALZ.org and donating to the WGN Sunday morning team. We raised almost $5,000.
Nice.
We're up to almost five.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. We are way in excess of what our goal was, but if you would like to add to it, this money goes to the Alzheimer's Association, ALZ.org, click on donate, and then click on search for a team, click and just type in WGN, you can just put WGN Sunday morning, whatever you want, but WGN will take you to our section, and you can support the valiant athletic efforts that Schwani, Andy, and I put forward doing the walk yesterday for the Alzheimer's Association.
It was a marathon, wasn't it?
It was
our marathon.
You know, it was amazing, too. I posted some of the pictures on my Facebook page and was getting a ton of comments of people just saying, thank you, because I've been affected by this in this way, and I've been affected by it in this way. And, you know, we made a lot of fun of it because it was a good time for us, but it was a serious cause, of course.
And of course.
You never really realize the impact that that a disease has on people until you get out there and you hear about them on Facebook.
You start talking to people out there and seeing what they're going through and meeting people who are living with Alzheimer's, what their caregivers are going through. I mean, that's why we did it, because all of us have been or are currently affected by all of this. So
I would think nearly everyone would be affected directly or indirectly by this.
Yep. Yep. That's why, as much as we goof around about it, and I will never forget Schwani describe, literally, I'm not kidding, people think I'm exaggerating, literally describing every bush, tree, nut, and berry that we walk past, giving us lectures on Chicago architecture, and it was...
What was I talking about with the architecture?
The column.
That was a gift to the city of Chicago.
Oh, here we go again.
During the Century of Progress.
Here we go again. I asked him about the light pole that was next to it, if that had any significance, and apparently it didn't.
Here's what's going through my mind while he's giving us a half an hour lecture on this column. Why didn't I bring my earbuds with me?
You asked. We could have walked by it. I wouldn't have said a word.
I was just trying to make a little conversation.
I wouldn't have said a word. And you said, well, now, where does this pillar come from? And I knew, and I gave you the answer.
You sure did.
And if he didn't know, he was very convincing in telling us.
Right. We do have our team of fact checkers out there this morning just to verify what some of the things that you told us, because I'm pretty sure you were making half of it up. But thank you to everybody who is nice enough to support our team. Thank you for the very generous donations. I know the Alzheimer's Association is very, very grateful, as are we. And again, you can still donate. ALZ.org. Click on donate. Click on search for a team. Put in WGN, and you can add to the total as well. We appreciate that very much.
So wake me up when it's all over.
Oh, yeah.
When I'm
2 hours, 5K of that yesterday. We'll never forget. It's 11:42. This is Dean Richards. Sunday morning, WGN. So for the past couple of days, I've been in Los Angeles, California. As you know, I go out there or to New York frequently, see the movies, interview the stars, and we did for what is one of the most anticipated movies of the year, The Irishman. That stars Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, Joe Pesci, Harvey Keitel, comedians Ray Romano and Sebastian Maniscalco in dramatic roles and really good performances in this Martin Scorsese-directed mob drama that will be opening here in Chicago on November the 8th in theaters, and then will be on Netflix on November the 27th. So I'm on the scourge of my life, the red carpet, for this movie, got to talk to most of the stars that were coming through. And I see my friend Pamela Powell, who has been here on the program with us many times, from Real Honest Reviews, from FF2 Media, Kankakee Daily Journal, WCIA-TV, and also Chuck Kuplinski from Chicago. We had a good representation of Chicago critics out there. Nice to have you back in studio, Globetrotter. Welcome back here.
I'm just trying to keep up with you.
It's a little crazy sometimes, doesn't it?
It truly does, but I wouldn't trade it for anything. It was an amazing experience.
Yeah, Netflix. Yeah. They held the premiere of the movie at the famous Chinese Theater on Hollywood Boulevard, which is always pretty cool. I mean, they completely shut down the street.
Right.
This is a major street in Hollywood. So the stars can walk the carpet, and then you go into this historic theater and watch the movie. Before all of that, Scorsese comes up on stage, introduces the cast, talks a little about the movie, and then we sat there for 3.5 hours.
Three and a half hours.
I'll just say, I loved the movie. It's 3.5 hours long. That's a long time for anything.
That is. And we had that time change, too, because we were actually watching the movie at 10 p.m. our time. And I'm in bed at 9 usually.
Right.
So that was a little tough for me, too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's late. So, you know, that said, when the movie comes out, I mean, seeing it on big screen is a special experience. But you will be sitting there for 3.5 hours. That's challenging.
It is.
But it's going to be coming on Netflix, so you can watch it at home. stop it when you want to, take a break, and then go back to the movie. That's the way I'm recommending that people see this. But I loved it. I mean, this was my reaction when I came out. This is a masterclass in filmmaking. Scorsese maybe never has been doing better work than this. It's a masterclass in acting. De Niro, Pacino, Joe Pesci, if he doesn't win an Academy Award this year, is stunning. Harvey Keitel. Just go down the list. This cast is amazing.
It's an incredible cast, and I walked out the same way. And for me to watch a 3.5-hour movie and be totally engrossed in it, and I agree. I think Scorsese, I think everyone just jumped it up a higher level that I didn't know was even possible to attain. Truly, it is a masterclass. And some of the filmmaking techniques that they used were just absolutely incredible, from the de-aging types of technology that they're having, as well as just Scorsese pulling you into every single scene and engaging you and having compassion for a hitman, a mobster. That is an incredible script.
Yeah, I mean, that's I'm not going to give away too much of what happens here, but just kind of basically, De Niro is a former truck driver. As a young man, he was a truck driver. He gets hooked up with the mob and becomes kind of a fixer for the mobs. He gets things done for the mob bosses that want to get things done, and that eventually leads into hits and all kinds of mob kind of things that we've seen in Scorsese movies for in the past. But it's the story told through his eyes of dealing with the mob, and also with Jimmy Hoffa, who Al Pacino plays, I think, beautifully in this. Those two performances, De Niro and Pacino, are stunning to watch.
Absolutely. Their interaction and connection with each other is just so authentic and believable in that chemistry that is there. And truly, I think De Niro and I loved Pesci's performance, but I really, really loved Al Pacino's performance in this. I thought the two of those people together were incredible.
Yeah. You talk about watching master actors at work. These guys are the real deal. I was someplace last night, and somebody was telling me how much they liked The Joker, which is the number one movie, third week in a row, and Joaquin Phoenix's performance, which I also loved. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing performance.
Right.
But you take something like that and these fully dimensional performances by Pesci, by Pacino, by De Niro, versus a Joaquin Phoenix, I've got a lot of questions in my mind now of what might happen at the Academy Awards.
It's going to be exciting. That's what's going to be happening. It's just going to be so much energy and trying to figure out who truly is the best actor in that group. I think it's going to be a coin toss. We'll have to discuss that later on. But yeah, I don't think Robert De Niro or Al Pacino could have even given those performances 10 or 20 years ago. I think these seasoned actors have such a richness to their performances because of who they are and who they've become with their own experiences superimposed into those roles. Incredible.
Part of what you've probably seen in trailers or commercials for this movie is the de-aging process that everybody's talking about, where you see De Niro 30 years ago, and technically, digitally in the movie, they make him look younger, in Pacino and all the rest, and a lot of people are talking about that. That's almost a blip on the screen for me here, because it's done so flawlessly.
Right.
You're never aware, except maybe for a second, that, oh, that's De Niro as a young man. It looks like De Niro as a young man. It's kind of cool to see. But also what I like, because this story is about these guys, these mob guys in the movie, aging and maturing and learning and making mistakes. The actors, I think, brought their own experience of getting older and more mature and making mistakes and life experiences into this. So in that way, it just feels more well-rounded to me.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm wondering, do you think they'll have an app on your phone so that you can actually do that to yourself?
Change yourself. Yeah.
They're probably de-aging.
There probably already is one like that right now. One of the things, I was on the red carpet, and tomorrow on the TV morning news, we'll show you some more of the red carpet interviews, but I just wanted to play a quick clip of when I was talking with Pacino on the red carpet, and he was talking about researching Jimmy Hoffa, the real Jimmy Hoffa, who is a pretty public figure, who we know, and how he brought the character to life.
One of the things I learned about Jimmy Hoffa, because I studied him, and there's a lot of data on people. You know, there's a lot of out in the world today with the internet, and everybody's in there. You know, they give you their biology. They give you biology, but they also give you biography. He's a man that has he was someone who started unions and wanted people to get together and wanted them to get their due, working people. And he was sent to prison too. And in prison, he got prisoners together to help. You know, he was that kind of person that was drawn to that kind of thing. He had the range. He liked, he was at odds with Robert Kennedy Jr. You know, they were fighting, and yet one of his people that he loved was Dr. Martin Luther King. So, in a sense, this was his scope.
Working with Scorsese, was it great?
Of course. Oh, yeah, it's Marty Scorsese. It's great. He's great. Not only is he gifted and all that, he's so experienced and has done it so long. So you feel that, and it really has an effect. You really makes an effect.
The ninth time that De Niro has worked with Scorsese, and unbelievably, the first time that Pacino and Scorsese worked together.
Right. You just automatically think that all of these people have always worked together over the last five or six decades, but they haven't. And during the press conference afterwards, they told some really funny stories. And one of the things was about aging, and Pacino had to pretend he was 49 years old, but when he was doing the take, he was acting like he was 70 something, which is what he is.
His physical body,
right.
getting out of a chair, how when you get older you're
need a little
how
arm
people
rest
do
up, yeah.
Right. And he said, you're not somebody said to Scorsese, he's not standing up like a 40 year old, he's standing up like a 70 year old. And Scorsese said, you go tell him. I'm not going to tell him.
Not in his first time working with him.
Right.
Nope.
Yeah.
But they actually had a physical therapist on set to be able to tell them, this is how you should be doing these different things popping out of your chair. So pretty interesting.
Really interesting. I'm going to really look forward to, once you see the movie again and analyze it, let's come back here.
Perfect.
And we can talk about it some more. It's always nice to see you.
Oh, it's great to be here.
I think I've determined what one of our next field trips should be. Sunday morning field trips. We're going to be at Tree Time Christmas Creations in Lake Barrington in 2 weeks from today.
Right.
We're going to do our annual show there. But wouldn't it be fun if we took a group of Sunday morning listeners and we did one of those supernatural tours of Chicago and went to actual haunted places?
Did you ever go on one of those with the
Richard
legendary
Crow?
Richard Crow?
I never did.
Oh, that was so
had
much
on,
fun.
Had him on the show a million times, and I never got to do it. And Richard has since passed away.
Yeah.
So, but somebody, I know they still do those supernatural tours, but nobody talked about it and was as passionate about it as Richard. I thought for sure since Richard passed away, he would have appeared someplace since then. If anybody would do that, it would be him.
One of the highlights of that tour was standing outside of Hull House,
right,
and him explaining all the stuff that went on in there, and it was a little spooky. It was one of those nights, you know, where there was low clouds and it kind of reflected off the lights of the city, and
a
little strange.
He would take you out to Bachelor's Grove Cemetery in Midlothian and Resurrection Cemetery. Resurrection Mary runs across Archer Avenue all the time. She's, you know, been sightings of that, to outside the old Biograph Theater, which is now Victory Gardens.
We went
Gardens.
By the Biograph and the old Red Lion across the street.
Right, that's where famous gangland murders took place. The place where the St. Valentine's murders took place.
On North Clark Street.
And dogs allegedly bark at nothing. Presumably ghosts and spirits, right? Wouldn't that be fun?
That would be great.
I would love that.
That would be great.
Why don't you organize that?
Why don't I have?
Let me know. Let me know when you get that put together, will you?
Sound like that commercial. Good. Get some estimates for me and put it together. Get back to me tonight, will you?
Perfect. I'm glad you understand what I'm saying. That's good. This ties us into our next guest, Jessica Malernick, who is the author of a book called Secret Chicago. The Secret Chicago book is a source of spooky places and things and people around Chicago that would be kind of fun to take in just before Halloween. Jessica, welcome to WGN. Nice to have you with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Now, you must have gone on some of these supernatural tours, I would think, if you've written a book like this.
I have gone on some, and the book covers 90 places in Chicago and a few surrounding the city. They're not all spooky, but it's a book of weird and unusual places, so many of them are spooky, yes.
Well, let's start with some of the Halloween-oriented places. What do you think are like some of the great places that people should to see and experience?
Well, I think if you are getting ready for Halloween, you should definitely stop by Woolly Mammoth Antiques and Oddities, which is a shop in Andersonville. They have all kinds of creepy stuff from around the world. It's run by a husband and wife, and they go around the world collecting things like Victorian jewelry made out of human hair that was like a mourning decoration, old dental slides, taxidermy, a lot of medical related things, astrology. So if you need like a two-headed taxidermied animal to put in your living room for Halloween, it's a great place.
Who doesn't need one, really?
Right. They've got all kinds of creepy stuff like that. It's a fun shop to go browse around any time of the year, but yeah, especially right now if you're looking for some decor that will entertain your visitors.
That definitely falls in the unusual and slightly spooky category. What are some others?
Well, I think a lot of people know that in Chicago, the first nuclear reaction occurred down at the University of Chicago. But do you know where the reactor went after the Manhattan Project moved?
I do not.
It did not go far. Kind of unsettling. It's just buried out in the Cook County Forest Preserve. So that's a place near Redgate Woods is a picnic area. Uh-huh. And you can actually go hike to, there are two spots. One is where the nuclear reactor is buried, and one is where a lot of the other radioactive materials are buried. And there are signs marking them, and you can just go have a picnic there if you want.
Okay. All right. That sounds like that would be fun to have a picnic at the site of a former nuclear reactor. What else
do
we have?
They did some testing on the site. I think in the 70s there was some low-level radioactivity still going on there, but these days I think it's okay to hang out.
I know that you also write about a bookstore that specializes in the occult. I mean, people want to learn more, get more information on it. Which is the one that you're talking about?
Yes, that's the Occult Bookstore. They were located in Wicker Park, and they just moved their shop down to Grand Avenue. But they've got books. They're actually the oldest occult bookstore in the country. They're 101 years old now, I believe. But they've got things on all kinds of different world religions, occult, books on angels, demons, herbs. You know, they sell crystals, and they actually had a garden where they would grow herbs and different things that are used in potions, and then they would sell them in the store as well. So if you're in need of any kinds of special crystals or just a book on interpreting your dreams, anything like that, there's tons of interesting information there. And everyone who works there specializes in different areas of cult.
Very, that's creepy and also kind of interesting at the same time. We're talking about Bachelor's Grove Cemetery and Resurrection Cemetery because of the alleged ghost sightings that have, you know, have long since been talked about in Chicago. But there is also the Oak Woods Cemetery that doesn't get as much talk. What is the significance of Oak Woods?
Yeah, this one is really interesting to me. I did not grow up in Chicago. I've been here for a decade, but I didn't associate a lot of Civil War history with Chicago. But it's Chicago is home to the largest mass grave in the Western Hemisphere, actually, and it's located in Oakwood Cemetery. So where Bronzeville is now, there was a Civil War camp called Camp Douglas, and the land was donated by Senator Stephen Douglas, so it's named after him. It started off as a Union training camp. But then a lot of the Confederate prison camps were getting crowded, so they shipped everybody up to Chicago. And unfortunately, the conditions there were not great. A lot of people got sick and died. So this is a monument to 4,000 Confederate soldiers who died in Chicago. And it's the largest mass grave in the Western Hemisphere. So you can go see all their names inscribed. Yeah.
I've lived here all my life. I've known that Oakwood Cemetery is a historic cemetery in which many people, very famous people like Jesse Owens, like Ida B. Wells, Mayor Washington,
Harold Washington,
among others, are buried. I never knew that part of history. In fact, I don't think I've ever heard any Civil War history related to the city of Chicago before.
Yeah, I was very surprised to find this. It's a tall monument, has everyone's name inscribed on it, and some other Civil War cannons and things nearby. But I'm always happy to hear when lifelong Chicagoans get to learn something from the book too.
Yeah, well, that's part of the part of the reason I wanted to talk to you in this, talk about this very interesting book, because there's not only things, Halloween or scary, spooky, supernaturally kind of things in here, just a lot of like really cool, quirky little facts about the city of Chicago that I'm always delighted to hear about these kinds of things. Was there one thing that surprised you more than anything else when you were putting the book together?
I think my favorite place in the book that's really surprising is also a bit spooky. It's the smallest graveyard in Chicago, which is located down at around 95th Calumet. It's one guy's grave, and he fought against Napoleon in the Battle of Waterloo. And he lost an arm, so he was a one-armed fisherman living in Germany. He moved to Chicago, and then he died a year later, and he was buried on his land. The land was then taken over years later by an industrial company and turned into a scrapyard. But his family fought in the courts to have his grave preserved there. So a scrapyard grew up around this one guy's grave, and it's still there today.
Wow.
And it's just him there.
95th and Calumet, you said?
Yes.
I never knew that.
Yeah, so the scrapyard is actually closed. His name is Andreas von Zerngibel.
Okay.
But the Southeast Historical Society does give tours once in a while. And it's interesting now that the scrapyard has closed, the area, it's kind of getting a little more overgrown and maybe going back to nature a bit, like more, looks more like it did when he lived there potentially.
Yeah. Like a, more like a prairie than, an industrial area. Never knew that. And I grew up not far from that area as well. That's something that, I probably should have known as a kid. There was something so unusual there. Let me take a quick break. When we come back, I want to open up our phone lines to people who may have had some spooky encounters, some stories like that. I've got a resurrection. You've heard of Resurrection Mary, no doubt, right?
I've heard of her. We have not met, though.
Oh, you have not met. Well, I'll have to introduce you sometime. I claim that I've had a Resurrection Mary experience. I'll share that, but I know that our listeners have had spooky, ghostly kind of experiences in their own homes at some of the famous places that are well known for, you know, so-called ghost sightings. 1223, Dean Richards, WGN. Coming up on our Food Time segment after the 1230 news update, how adventurous an eater are you? Exotic foods, I want to know if you'd eat them. And what kinds of, how adventurous you've been. I always remember the story that Orion Samuelson told me about eating monkey brains. Sounds like something for a Halloween party, doesn't it? But he was in, I think, China or India. I forget one of his international adventures that he had where he was, he didn't want to insult his hosts who offered him monkey brains, and he ate it. I've eaten some weird things, never monkey brains, but I'm wondering if you have some of those things. We'll get to all of that coming up in our Food Time segment, coming up after the 1230 news update. Jessica Malernick is on the phone with us, the author of the new book, Secret Chicago Book, a go-to source for Chicago's spookiest people, places, and things. And Jessica, I wanted to tell you about my 312-981-7200, by the way. If you've had a spooky encounter, maybe in your own home, you think is there a ghost in your house? Have you been someplace where a ghostly occurrence has taken place? That's what I want to hear about. 312-981-7200. is our phone number. So, Jessica, do you know the legend of Resurrection Mary?
I do know the legend. And you met her yourself?
Well, I think I did. I think I did. She is said to have been the beautiful blonde girl who was killed in a car accident when she was returning from the Willowbrook Ballroom out in the Western Springs area, and she was killed in an automobile accident. And people who now drive on Archer Avenue in that area claim to see a beautiful blonde girl running back and forth in and out of Resurrection Cemetery through the bars that protect the cemetery, running back and forth on the street. And, you know, as like a 20-year-old, 20, 25-year-old, my buddies and I would go out there to see if we could see Resurrection Mary. And I swear that I saw a beautiful blonde girl running through the cemetery in the middle of the night. I think I've seen her.
Did she try to get a ride from you?
She did not. She did not. That's actually
the thing, right?
Yeah, that's part of the legend where she hitchhikes and somebody stops. It's a beautiful girl, you know, out on the street. You know, gets in the car and then suddenly disappears in the car. That's part of the legend as well. I've never had like a personal encounter, just seen her from afar. I guess maybe in these days where people aren't hitchhiking anymore, it's fallen out of fashion. Where it's just,
well, she jumps in the Uber without paying and disappears.
Yeah, even as a ghost, stranger danger takes precedence, I guess. Over. How did you find some of these places that you write about in the book?
I really wanted to cover a lot of ground all over the city. So there are some things that when I moved here, I just started noticing and researching on my own. So I kind of plotted those on a map, and then I looked for the holes, the neighborhoods, the areas that I wasn't as familiar with, and I went into those communities and I talked to historical societies and community leaders and bartenders, because they have a lot of neighborhood secrets stored up. So that was very helpful.
People want to get more information on the book. What is the best way to do that?
They can check out secretchicagobook.com. And they can also pick it up at some of the local bookshops around town, the Wicker Park Secret Agent Supply Company, the Bookseller, City Lit, Volumes, lots of bookstores around town as well.
SecretChicagoBook.com. Jessica Malone, thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me, and I hope everyone gets out this week and gets in the spooky spirit.
It's 11:50. This is Dean Richards. Our Food Time segment this week: how adventurous an eater are you? What kinds of wild things have you eaten? That's what I'm curious about. And we start off with John in Lake Zurich. Hi, you're on WGN.
Good morning.
Hello, sir.
Yes, can you hear me?
I can hear you perfectly. What wild things have you eaten, John?
Chicken heads and dogs.
Chicken heads and dogs. Tell me the story of how this happened.
Well, it was a while back, and I was in a Southeast Asian country, and I was the guest of honor at a little feast.
Oh. And which country is this?
Vietnam.
In Vietnam. And is it common to eat dog in Vietnam?
It was. I hadn't been there for a while.
Yeah. I've heard that in some Asian countries, that it's not that uncommon, you know, where dogs are used as food. And what was the other one? Chicken head, you said?
Chicken head.
What is a
head of a chicken?
What does a chicken head taste like?
Well, it's kind of crunchy.
Okay.
And I really can't ascribe a flavor to it.
Yeah, tastes like chicken, I'll bet.
I honestly don't think it tasted any like any other chicken I've ever had.
Yeah, are the
there are a lot of spices involved too.
Oh, okay,
so all right. Spices, but yeah. The sauce like kimchi.
Yeah, mask the flavor up a little bit. Is it intact when it's served to you? I mean, are the eyes on?
Oh yeah,
it's looking
right
at
on
you.
Top of the rice. Right on top of the rice.
Wow. Okay. Wow.
And it's an insult if you don't eat it.
And so. It's an insult. Yeah, that's what when Orion was telling me about the monkey brains, that I think it was kind of a similar thing where it was served to him as an honor, and it would be insulting to not take it. John, hold on for just a second, because I want to send you a 4-pack of movie passes to Classic Cinemas. Go to classiccinemas.com for more information on where to go. This is Dawn in Libertyville next. Hi, you're on WGN.
Hi, Dean. How are you?
People always say on our Food Time show, we make them hungry. It may be just the opposite today.
The escargot made me hungry. But when I was a little girl, my mom was from immigrant Croatian parentage.
Uh-huh.
So she used to make this dish, and she called it fish. And the fish had a red sauce, and it was like a white, you know, kind of pasty white, honeycomb-ish kind of appearance. And I guess she thought if she put red sauce on it that she would fool me. Well, she did for a while until I found out it was tripe.
Oh, stomach. Beef stomach,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And it was like awful. I mean, it was the chewy and just rubbery and gross and I don't know. So she not only gave me something, you know, that I didn't think it was, but she also lied to me, you know.
Yeah.
There
is. I've seen tripe in the, you know, the meat counter all my life. I've never had it. It looks, it looks disgusting.
And my mom liked menudo. She liked, you know, the soup, the tripe soup.
Sure.
But yeah, not I.
There is a soup that Greeks make at Easter time called Magheritsa. That is, it's like all the parts of the lamb that you don't use when you serve lamb. It's the intestines. It's the heart. It's the everything that's left over. It's chopped up and it's cooked into this soup. At Easter time, and you know, kids are horrified, of course, but their parents make them eat it because it's an Easter tradition. It's actually,
I bet it smells good with all the spices and the garlic. I bet you can't even tell the difference.
If you don't know what you're eating, it's actually very, very tasty. I'm not sure if it's as tasty as a Lou Malnati's pizza. I'm going to send you.
Oh my God! Awesome, awesome.
I'm going to send you a gift certificate, Dawn. Thank you for the call. I appreciate it. This is Ernie. You're on WGN. Welcome to Gross Out 720 today.
Yeah, how are you, sir?
Very well.
I've had two animals that I guess you'd have a hard time finding on menus in the States. I've had donkey.
Wow.
And I've had kangaroo.
Interesting.
And you've heard of beef tartare. Well, I had kangaroo tartare. And it's prepared the same way. You know, you take the egg yolk, you got the onion, you blend it together.
Yeah.
Instead of putting it on toast points, which is what they would do here, they gave us potato chips. And I must tell you that we had an Australian Chardonnay, and this was in Australia, of course. The Chardonnay went very, very well with it. It's very gamey, but it wasn't off-putting, and it's the one and only time I've had it. So
and you served raw.
Raw roux is what you call it.
Raw roux is what it's called.
Raw roux.
Okay, so if anyone's ever in Australia and you're offered raw roux, it's not.
I would opt to taste it.
I would very definitely taste that. That's
and when you go to the markets in Australia, because I've spent much time there, you'll find ground up kangaroo in the meat section.
Oh, very interesting.
Like ground up beef and ground up pork.
What does donkey taste like?
Well, this was cooked donkey, so it was kind of chewy. I remembered it was almost like beef jerky. That's what I remember. Huh. I had that in China. And of course, I have to make a joke. You know, a donkey's called a jackass. How many times I've been called a jackass? So I guess I am what I eat.
Hang on for a second here. I want to get you a pair of tickets for the production at Lyric Opera, Dead Man Walking, that's playing November 2nd through the 22nd there. Yeah. I'm going to see if I can get them to serve some donkey at the concession stand at the Lyric Opera. All right, that's going to wrap things up for us today. We'll see you tomorrow morning on the WGN-TV Morning News, 8 to 8:30 on Steve Cochran Show. More on entertainment. We always have tons of fun.